possible with aggressive nutritional management, how many patients do you think would choose to have their chest split open with bypass surgery? Even if you are lucky enough to have no postoperative complications from bypass, some degree of brain injury occurs in almost every patient from the time spent hooked up to the heart-lung machine. On neuropsychological testing 6 months later, about 20% still show deterioration. Brain injury can range from subtle degrees of intellectual impairment or memory loss to personality changes and permanent brain damage. Even if you do fine after angioplasty, stent placement or bypass atherosclerosis develops at a faster rate in those arteries that were subject to bypass or angioplasty. The plaque grows faster after surgery. Approximately 25% of arteries treated by angioplasty clog up again within 4 to 6 months. This is called restenosis. Restenosis is an iatrogenic, physician-caused disease. Because restenosis involves scarring, it does not behave like native atherosclerosis and does not respond as favorably or as predictably to lifestyle modifications later on. In other words, because of the changes made to the atherosclerotic plaque by the angioplasty treatment, the blockages are less responsive to nutritional intervention when they return. Many patients are worse off after treatment, not better. If they had followed my coronary artery disease reversal plan instead, they would be watching their heart get healthier each week. Stenting attempts to reduce this high risk of restenosis, but has not solved the problem. Stents are tiny wire mesh tubes that are laced in the narrow segments of arteries that were stretched by balloon angioplasty. A stent may also cause vascular instability or inflammation where the stent ends and the native plaque begins, thus increasing the risk for coronary thrombosis. It would be good to remind patients that revascularization procedures do not influence the underlying disease because the rest of the coronary vasculature, with diffuse, non-angiographical, noticeable atherosclerosis, is still there posing a risk for future cardiac events, whether the procedure is done or not. Heart attacks most commonly occur when plaque of a lipid-rich segment ruptures. These vulnerable areas of plaque are not necessarily those that are seen as significantly narrowed on catheterization. Heart attacks still occur in the minimally narrowed segments, areas that may appear normal on catheterization and stress testing. Most of an iceberg is hidden underwater. Normal stress test results of cardiac catheterization results do not mean you do not have atherosclerosis. You can have a heart attack the day after you are told your vessels are clear. These tests show only advanced disease. Massive atheromas, or fatty deposits, lurking within the vascular wall, outside the view of angiography, or cardiac catheterization, account for 2/3 of myocardial infarctions. Most heart attacks occur at sites invisible to the tests done by cardiologists. This is why invasive cardiac procedures relieve pain but do not have an impressive record of reducing the risk of future heart attacks. Only strong risk factor control with aggressive nutritional intervention can reverse diffuse disease, avoiding the high probability of that heart attack occurring down the road. Your survival depends on risk factor management. Quitting smoking and lowering your weight, blood pressure, glucose, cholesterol, and insulin levels as a result of careful nutrition, not the procedures done by the interventional cardiologist or cardiac surgeon. Only then will beneficial changes occur in the plaque composition, promoting healing of the blood vessel's lining that will stabilize the vessel wall and substantially reduce the risk of a heart attack. You are deluding yourself if you think chelation or drugs alone will reverse your condition while you remain overweight and nutritionally malnourished. Chelation will not dissolve your atherosclerosis as claimed. The studies done on this therapy are not impressive. In spite of chelation, patients generally continued to deteriorate unless they changed their diet, lost weight, and lowered their cholesterol. In other words, changes not related to chelation. The areas of vulnerable plaque that cause heart attacks have a large fatty core of cholesterol. Removing the lipid from the plaque can make it smaller and more resistant to rupture. Use common sense. Chelation could no more suck fatty substance out of a coronary artery than it could suck the fat off your left hip. There is no way chelating agents can selectively remove the lipids in atheromas. These atheromas that form on the inside of our blood vessels are fatty tumors with a fibrous cap. They shrink and become more resistant to rupture proportionally to, and as a result of, weight reduction, caloric restriction, nutritional excellence, and aggressive lipid lowering. The most impressive results of shrinking and removing atheromas occur after the person has lost all excess body fat. Body fat is designed for energy storage. Atheromas are more difficult to remove. They resolve after other fat storage sites have been depleted. Fortunately, the same body that created the atheromas has the ability to disintegrate them. Many of my patients were advised by other physicians to undergo angioplasty or bypass. When they refused, they were referred to my office and chose aggressive nutritional management. Without exception, they have all done well. Chest pain has resolved in almost every case. Only one went to repeat angioplasty because of a recurrence of chest symptoms. And none has died from cardiac disease. A typical patient is John Polakowski. I see patients like him almost every day. John's story is not unusual, but a miracle to him, nevertheless. John came to me with a history of steadily worsening angina. His chest pains were increasing. His stress thallium test suggested multivessel coronary artery disease. He underwent a cardiac catheterization, which revealed a 95% stenosis of the left anterior descending artery, and the left circumflex had diffuse disease. He had normal heart function. His cholesterol was 218, he weighed 180 pounds, and he was on two blood pressure medications. Within a few weeks of following my diet, John's chest pain ceased and he stopped taking nitroglycerin tablets for chest pain relief. In 2 months, his weight dropped to 152, a loss of 28 pounds in 8 weeks, and his stress test normalized. Today, 16 years later, he still weighs 150 pounds, following the same diet. He is well, with no heart problems, and is physically fit. His blood pressure runs about 120 over 70. He is 88 years old and requires no medication. John's laboratory reports: cholesterol on 6694 of 218 by 5599, 161, a 26% change. Triglycerides went from 140 to 80, a 43% change. His HDL went from 48 to 65, a 35% increase. And his LDL went from 144 to 80, a 44% change for the better. Cholesterol HDL ratio on 6694 was 4.7 by 5.5.1999 was 2.4, a 49% change for the better. Revascularization procedures may be necessary in rare circumstances, such as triple vessel disease with reduced cardiac output or an injured or stunned heart muscle. However, I am convinced that aggressive nutritional therapy with the addition of nutritional supplements and, if needed, medication, will provide a more favorable outcome for the majority of patients than angioplasty, stent placement, and bypass. One might argue, where are the adequate studies that prove this? But where are the studies to prove revascularization will give a better outcome with a stable patient without a reduction in cardiac output? The benefits of revascularization procedures for patients with good cardiac function have not been convincingly demonstrated, and there is considerable evidence to suggest that the adverse outcomes outweigh the potential benefits. Furthermore, these dubious results are measured against patients who refuse revascularization and then follow the normal, worthless, dietary recommendations. When we factor in the results I see with very aggressive nutritional management, it seems likely that many patients would be at lower risk if they avoided invasive cardiac procedures and surgery. Fortunately, I am not the only physician in America with this opinion, but sometimes it sure seems as if I am. Rarely will you find a cardiologist who advises aggressive nutritional therapy before angioplasty or bypass. And physicians who offer medical interventions are usually satisfied if blood pressure is below 140 over 90 and cholesterol level is under 200. Those levels are not sufficiently normal to offer true protection. Your doctor lied. You do have high blood pressure and high cholesterol. Studies clearly demonstrate that the higher one's cholesterol level, the higher the risk of heart disease. Conversely, the lower one's cholesterol level, the lower the risk. For true protection, do not be satisfied until your LDL cholesterol is below 100. There is nothing particularly magical about the number 200. Heart disease risk continues to decrease as one's cholesterol decreases below this level. The average cholesterol level in China is 127. The Framingham Heart Study showed that participants with cholesterol levels below 150 did not have heart attacks. In fact, most heart attacks occur in patients whose cholesterol runs between 175 and 225. That is the average cholesterol range among Americans, and the average American has heart disease. Do you want to be average, or do you want to be healthy? I know you were told that if your blood pressure is below 140 over 90, it is normal. Unfortunately, this is not true either. It is average, not normal. This number is used because it is the midpoint of adult Americans older than 60. The risk for strokes and heart attacks starts climbing at 115 over 70. In societies where we do not see high rates of heart disease and strokes, we do not see blood pressure increase with age. Almost all Americans have blood pressure that is unhealthfully high. At a minimum, we should consider blood pressure higher than 125 over 80 abnormal. Numerous scientific investigations have shown that the following interventions have some degree of effectiveness in lowering blood pressure: weight loss, sodium restriction, increased potassium intake, increased calcium and magnesium intake, alcohol restriction, caffeine restriction, increased fiber intake, increased consumption of fruits and vegetables, increased physical activity or exercise. Studies have shown controlling sodium intake and weight loss to be effective in reducing blood pressure, even in the elderly. How can you integrate these interventions into your lifestyle? It's simple. Eat many more fruits, vegetables, and legumes, eat less of everything else, and engage in a moderate amount of exercise. High blood pressure is relatively simple to control. Though it took a full 2 years, Rhonda Wilson dropped her weight from 194 to a slim 119. She was also able to come off blood pressure medication as a result of her newfound commitment to a healthful lifestyle. When she first came to me, she was on two medications to control her high blood pressure. These two medications were not sufficient, as her blood pressure was still excessively high. Rhonda did not see normal blood pressure readings for a long time and was not able to stop her blood pressure medication until she became relatively thin. Her story illustrates a common dilemma. It is not unusual for some people to lose some weight yet still have high blood pressure. Some individuals develop high blood pressure and diabetes even from a small amount of excess body fat. For these individuals, it is even more important to maintain an ideal weight. I encourage my patients to do what it takes to normalize their blood pressure so they do not require medication. Prescribing medications for high blood pressure has the effect of giving someone a permission slip. Medication has a minimal effect in reducing heart attack occurrence in patients with high blood pressure because it does not remove the underlying problem, atherosclerosis. It just treats the symptom. Patients given medication now falsely believe they are protected, and they continue to follow the same disease-causing lifestyle that led to the problem to begin with, until the inevitable occurs, their first heart attack or stroke. Maybe if high blood pressure medications had never been invented, doctors would have been forced to teach healthful living and nutritional disease causation to their patients. It is possible that many more lives could have been saved. Only you, not your physician, must take full responsibility. Do not expect to receive valuable health advice from your typical doctor. Physicians usually do not help. They rush through their patient appointments, especially in the current HMO climate, because they are paid so poorly for each visit and are pressured to see as many patients as possible each day. Your physician is likely doing just as poorly as you are and eating just as unhealthfully, or worse. After reading this book, you could improve his or her health and reduce his risk of premature death more than he could help yours. Even when physicians offer their full time and effort, their recommendations are invariably too mild to have a significant benefit. Doctors Randall S. Stafford and David Blumenthal of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston reviewed the records of more than 30,000 office visits to 1,521 U.S. physicians of various specialties and found that doctors measured patients' blood pressure during 50% of the visits. However, doctors tested their patients' cholesterol levels only 4.6% of the time. Physicians offered patients advice on how to lose weight in 5.8% of the visits and suggestions on how to quit smoking 3% of the time. On average, doctors gave patients advice on dietary and other changes that can help lower cholesterol in 4.3% of the visits and advice on exercise in 11.5% of the visits. When records were reviewed for those who had cardiovascular disease, the typical, almost worthless, dietary counseling and exercise were usually never even mentioned. Obviously, we have a long way to go. Diabetes, the consequence of obesity. More than 20 million Americans have diabetes. As our population grows fatter, this figure is climbing. Diabetes is a nutritionally related disease, one that is both preventable and reversible, in the case of type 2 diabetes, through nutritional methods. Diabetes can take a severe toll, causing heart attacks and strokes, as well as other serious complications. More than 80% of adults with type 2 diabetes die of heart attacks and strokes. The statistics are even more frustrating when you watch people gain weight, become even more diabetic, and develop attendant complications, all while under the care of their physicians. As our country's weight has risen, diabetes has increased accordingly. The worldwide explosion in diabetes parallels the increase in body weight. Patients are told to learn to live with their diabetes and to learn to control it because it can't be cured. No, no, and no, I say. Don't live with it. Get thin and get rid of it, as many of my patients have. There are basically two kinds of diabetes, type 1 or childhood onset diabetes, and type 2 or adult onset diabetes. In type 1, which generally occurs earlier in life, children incur damage to the pancreas, the organ that produces and secretes insulin, so they have an insulin deficiency. In type 2, the most common type, the individual produces near normal levels of insulin, but the body is resistant to it, so the level of blood sugar or glucose rises. The end result is the same in both types. The individual has a high glucose level in his or her blood. Both types of diabetes accelerate the aging of our bodies. Diabetes greatly promotes the development of atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease, and it ages and destroys the kidneys and other body systems. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness in adults and is the leading cause of kidney failure. We witness today a huge number of type 2 diabetes patients with terrible complications, such as amputations, peripheral neuropathy, painful nerve damage in the legs, retinopathy, the major cause of blindness in diabetics, and nephropathy, kidney damage. Complications of type 2 diabetes are just as bad as those of type 1 diabetes. Diabetics, regardless of type, have higher levels of triglycerides and increased levels of LDL cholesterol than the general population. Diabetics have more than a 400% higher incidence of heart attacks than non-diabetics. One-third of all patients with insulin-dependent type 1 diabetes die of a heart attack before age 50. This acceleration of the atherosclerotic process and the resulting high mortality rate is present in both types of diabetes. By simple logic, you would expect that any dietary recommendations designed for diabetics would at least attempt to reduce the risk of heart attack, stroke, or other cardiovascular event. Unfortunately, the nutritional advice given to diabetics is to follow the same diet that has proved not to work for heart disease patients. Such a diet is risky for all people, but for the diabetic, it is exceptionally hazardous. It is deadly. The combination of refined grains, processed foods, and animal products guarantees a steady stream of available customers for hospitals and emergency rooms. When type 1 patients take a more aggressive and progressive nutritional approach, they can prevent many of the complications that befall diabetics. They can expect a normal lifespan, because it is the interaction between diabetes and the disease-causing modern diet that results in such dismal statistics, not merely being diabetic. Type 1 diabetics will still require some insulin, but often I find my type 1 diabetic patients requiring about half as much insulin as they did prior to adopting my life-saving program. Their sugars don't swing wildly up and down, and since they are using less insulin, they have less chance of developing potentially dangerous hypoglycemic episodes. Type 2 diabetics adopting this approach can become undiabetic and achieve wellness and even excellent health. They can be diabetes-free for life. Almost all my type 2 diabetic patients are weaned off insulin in the first month. Thanks to their excellent nutrition, these patients have much better, lower, blood sugars than when they were on insulin. The horrors of diabetes about to befall them are aborted. I have also observed patients who came to me with diabetic retinopathy and peripheral neuropathy gradually improve and eventually resolve their conditions. Dr. Milton Crane reported similar findings in his patients. 17 out of 21 patients who adopted a plant-rich vegan diet obtained complete relief from their peripheral neuropathy. Insulin for type 2 diabetes makes things worse. Insulin works less effectively when people eat fatty foods or gain weight. Diets containing less fat improve insulin sensitivity, as does weight loss. An individual who is overweight requires more insulin, whether he or she is diabetic or not. In fact, giving overweight diabetic people even more insulin makes them sicker by promoting weight gain. They become even more diabetic. How does this process work? Our pancreas secretes the amount of insulin demanded by the body. A person of normal weight with about a third of an inch of periumbilical fat will secrete X amount of insulin. Let's say this person gains about 20 pounds of fat. His body will now require more insulin, almost twice as much, because fat on the body blocks the uptake of insulin into the cells. If the person is obese, with more than 50 pounds of excess fat, his body will demand huge loads of insulin from the pancreas, even as much as 10 times more than a person of normal weight needs. So what do you think happens after 5 to 10 years of forcing the pancreas to work so hard? You guessed it, pancreatic poop out. The pancreas begins to secrete less insulin, in spite of the huge demands of the body. Eventually, with less insulin available to move glucose from the bloodstream into the cells, the glucose level in the blood starts to rise and the person gets diagnosed with diabetes. In most cases, these individuals are still secreting an excessive amount of insulin compared with a person of normal weight, just not enough for them. When they eat a less taxing diet and lose weight, they don't need the extra insulin to control the sugars. What this means is that typical type 2 diabetes is caused by overweight in individuals who have a smaller reserve of insulin-secreting cells in the pancreas. In the susceptible individual, even 10 to 20 pounds of excess weight could make the difference. Losing the extra weight enables these individuals to live within the capabilities of their body. Most type 2 diabetics still produce enough insulin to maintain normalcy as long as they maintain a thinner, normal weight. Following my program is the most important thing a diabetic individual can do to extend his or her lifespan. It has been known for years that intentional weight loss improves diabetics' blood sugars, lipids, and blood pressure. One study documented a significant increase in life expectancy with an average of 25% reduced premature mortality when diabetic individuals drop their body weight. Other studies have come to similar conclusions. Imagine the results when a program of nutritional excellence achieves the weight loss. Insulin is a dangerous drug for type 2 diabetics. These are people who are overweight to begin with. Insulin therapy will result in further weight gain, accelerating their diabetes. A vicious cycle begins that usually causes patients to require more and more insulin as they put on the pounds. When they come to see me for the first time, they report their sugars are impossible to control in spite of massive doses of insulin, which they are now combining with oral medication. It is like walking around with a live hand grenade in your pocket, ready to explode at any minute. Don't merely control your diabetes. Get rid of it for good. As my patients begin the program, I usually cut their insulin in half. The insulin is then gradually phased out over the next few days or weeks, depending on their response and how advanced their condition was when they started. Most patients can stop all insulin within the first few days. The warning I give to patients and their physicians adopting this program is not to underestimate how effective it can be. If the medications, especially insulin, are not dramatically reduced, a dangerous hypoglycemic reaction, driving the blood sugar level too low, can occur from over-medication. It is safer to under-medicate and let the glucose levels run a little high at first, then add back a little medication if necessary. This will minimize the risk of hypoglycemia. Since this diet is so powerfully effective in reversing diabetes and other diseases of nutritional neglect, it is essential that you work closely with a doctor who can help you adjust your medication dose downward in a careful fashion. Note, no diabetic patient on medication should make dietary changes without the assistance of a physician, as adjusting the medication will be necessary to prevent hypoglycemia or excessively lowering the blood sugar level. I typically continue or begin glucophage, metformin, or other similar drugs. The newer medications that do not interfere with weight loss are safer than the older oral medications diabetics used in the past. Eventually, as more weight is lost, these patients can have normal glucose levels without any medication. They become non-diabetic, though diabetes can recur should they adopt a more stressful and girth-growing diet. Gerardo Petito's case exemplifies the outcome I see with other diabetic patients on a regular basis. Gerardo stated that his main reason for coming to me was that he wanted to control his diabetes better. On his first visit, on January 18, 2000, he was taking three medications, Acupril, 20 milligrams for blood pressure, and two medications for diabetes, glucophage 500 twice daily and 15 units of insulin twice daily. He had been on insulin for 7 years. His fasting glucose in the morning had been running around 175 with this regimen. His blood pressure was 140 over 85, and he weighed 256 pounds. After a lengthy discussion, Gerardo agreed to follow my dietary advice. I instructed him to cut back his insulin dose to 10 units the evening of the visit and to 5 units the following morning. After that, he was to take no more insulin. When Gerardo came back for his second visit 2 weeks later, he weighed 237, a loss of 19 pounds in just 2 weeks. His glucose in the morning was averaging 115, and his blood pressure was down to 125 over 80. Other than checking his blood test and doing an EKG for the record, I made no changes in his program. He was enjoying the diet and following my advice to the letter. At Gerardo's third visit the next month, he weighed 221, a loss of 35 pounds in 52 days. He had just returned from a cruise where he continued to follow his healthful diet. His morning glucose was averaging around 80, completely normal, so I stopped the glucophage. His blood pressure was 88 over 70, so I discontinued the Acupril. 10 months after Gerardo's first visit, he weighed 190, a loss of 66 pounds. His cholesterol was 134, and his blood pressure was 112 over 76. His hemoglobin A1C, a measure of diabetic control, was 5.3. in the non-diabetic range. He was on no medication. Rather than controlling his blood pressure and diabetes, he chose to follow my advice and get rid of his medical problems altogether. Advice for the diabetic patient. The general advice given in this book is sufficient for most diabetics. The most important goal is how much weight you lose, not whether your glucose is a little higher or lower in the short run. Follow my guidelines for aggressive weight loss in the next chapter. If you follow my program to the letter, it will not be necessary to make your diet complicated by following diabetic food exchanges and counting calories. Most people do not have to measure portions either. Your goals are the same as the patient with coronary artery disease. Get thin and aggressively treat your risk factors. With time, your body will normalize your numbers. Keep the following guidelines in mind. 1. Refined starches such as white bread and pasta are particularly harmful. Avoid them completely. 2. Do not consume any fruit juice or dried fruits. Avoid all sweets except for fresh fruit in reasonable quantities. 2 or 3 fruits for breakfast is fine, and 1 fruit after lunch and dinner is ideal. The best fruits are those with less sugar: grapefruit, oranges, kiwi fruit, strawberries and other berries, melons, and green apples. 3. Avoid all oil. Raw nuts are permitted, but only 1 ounce or less. 4. The name of your diet is the greens and beans diet. Green vegetables and beans should make up most of your diet. 5. Limit animal food intake to no more than 2 servings of fish weekly. 6. Try to exercise regularly and consistently, like dispensing your medication. Do it on a regimented schedule, preferably twice daily. Walking stairs is one of the greatest exercises for weight loss. As the information in this book becomes your prescription for health, you can avoid heart attacks and strokes. If this diet were adopted by the general public, these illnesses would become rare and diabetes would practically disappear from our society. The Eat to Live formula lowers triglycerides. Some physicians and nutritionists believe that individuals suffering from obesity, diabetes, and elevated triglycerides may have good results in losing weight and controlling their high triglycerides and elevated glucose with a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet. They believe this because it has been observed that high-carbohydrate diets can raise triglyceride levels. I agree that a diet high in refined carbohydrates is not advised and will worsen this condition. However, I want to make it absolutely clear that these patients can achieve spectacular results without the added dangers of a diet high in animal protein and saturated fat. They merely need advice on how to modify the plant-based diet for their condition. They do so by eating a relatively high-protein plant-based diet that reduces the amount of low-fiber carbohydrates. The diet is heavy in beans, raw vegetables, and cooked greens. The results are invariably impressive. Headaches, hypoglycemia, and hunger. It's almost incredible to believe, but almost all patients with headaches and hypoglycemia get well permanently following the formula for health in this book. I believe it has very much to do with detoxification. The body can heal itself when the obstacles to healing or stressors are removed. The reason people can't ever make complete recoveries is that they are addicted to their bad habits and unhealthy ways of eating and drinking. Imagine if you were drinking 10 cups of coffee daily. If you stopped drinking coffee, you would feel ill. You might get headaches, feel weak, even get the shakes. Fortunately, this would resolve slowly over 4 to 6 days, and then you would be well. So, if you were this heavy coffee drinker, when do you think you would feel worse? Right after eating, upon waking up in the morning, or when delaying or skipping a meal? You are correct if you answered either upon first waking up or when delaying or skipping a meal. The body goes through withdrawal or detoxification most effectively when it is not busy digesting food. A heavy meal will stop the ill feelings, or you'll feel better if you just drink another cup of coffee, but the cycle of feeling ill will start all over again the minute the caffeine level drops or the glucose level in your blood starts to go down. Delaying a meal brings about symptoms most people call hunger. These symptoms include abdominal cramping, weakness, and feeling ill, the same as during drug withdrawal. This is not hunger. Our dietary habits, especially eating animal protein-rich foods 3 times a day, are so stressful to the detoxification system in our liver and kidneys that we start to get withdrawal or detoxification symptoms the minute we aren't busy processing such food. Real hunger is not that uncomfortable. True hunger is mediated by the hypothalamus in the brain. The hunger-related activity of the hypothalamus correlates best with an increased sensation of need in the mouth and throat area. You could feel better by drinking a cup of coffee every 3 hours, evenly spaced out, to keep your caffeine blood levels constant. Or you could take medications, such as Furoset, Cafergot, Excedrin, Escafurinol, Migranol, Wigraine, and others, whose active ingredients are narcotics, barbiturates, ergotamines, or caffeine. Or you can just get some amphetamines or cocaine from the alley behind the liquor store. Either way, I hope you understand that temporarily feeling better does not mean getting well. Putting toxic drugs in your body can only compromise your health and lead to further dependence and suffering. In order to detoxify, you need to feel worse, not better. Then, after the withdrawal symptoms are completed, you will truly become well. Feeling better can mean becoming sicker. Feeling worse, temporarily, may mean getting well. In medical school, my classmates and I learned from a researcher that animal protein places a detoxification stress on the liver and that the nitrogenous wastes generated are toxic. These metabolic toxins, about 14 of them, rise in the bloodstream and accompany the rise in uric acid after a meal rich in animal protein. Withdrawal from these toxins can cause uncomfortable symptoms in susceptible individuals, symptoms that many call hypoglycemia. The word hypoglycemia means low glucose in the bloodstream. It gives people the impression that the low glucose level itself is the cause of the problem. Certain uncommon medical conditions, such as insulin-secreting tumors, excessive diabetic medication, and other rare illnesses can cause hypoglycemia and even hypoglycemic coma. But I'm referring to those people with reactive hypoglycemia. They feel ill when they delay eating, but they do not have a serious medical condition, nor do their blood sugars drop dangerously low. Most people carrying this diagnosis do not have fasting glucoses below 50. When their blood is drawn when they delay eating and feel extremely ill, the blood sugar is usually not low enough to account for their feeling so ill. There seems to be no correlation between the severity of the symptoms and their low glucose levels, but they feel uncomfortable if they try to stop treating themselves with high-protein diets. It is a massive oversimplification to think that a lower level of glucose in the blood is the sole cause of this problem. I find that the people with the most troublesome symptoms do not even have low glucose levels. Many doctors learn during their training that if the liver is compromised, such as in cirrhosis, the patient cannot effectively remove these toxins and may consequently feel mentally affected, confused, and even psychotic unless they are fed a low-protein diet, generating a lower level of nitrogenous wastes. For this reason, it is standard medical care to feed a patient with advanced liver disease a low-protein diet. Most Americans are protein toxic, like the patient with cirrhosis, but less so. They are toxic because their body detoxification system struggles under the excessive nitrogen, in addition to all the salt, caffeine, sweets, trans fats, and other noxious chemicals we consume. So the stomach empties and we feel ill, not hungry. Most people are too toxic to feel hungry. Detoxification symptoms appear first. Most people are driven to eat because it is time to eat or because they feel detoxification discomfort. Most Americans have never felt true hunger in their entire overfed existence. Many people come into my office with a diagnosis of hypoglycemia, meaning they feel ill when they delay eating. They are often told to eat a diet with frequent feedings of high-protein food. I insist that this diet is the precise cause of the condition, not the remedy. It is no more a remedy than putting them on a cup of coffee every hour. Sure, they will feel better temporarily, but if they want to make a complete and lasting recovery, they must unscramble their thinking. They must put up with about 1 week of not feeling so great. But then, they can be set free from their discomfort and their addiction to bad habits and a toxic diet. When I first begin treating patients with hypoglycemic symptoms, I continue them on snacks between meals and use some raw nuts and beans at each meal. They are forbidden to consume any refined carbohydrates, such as bread, pasta, sweets, or fruit juice, to prevent swings in insulin. In some individuals, insulin levels swing up too high and then too low merely because they are eating refined sugars and refined grains and not natural, unrefined food. These individuals are just sensitive to the junk food eaten by most Americans. The notoriously unreliable glucose tolerance test, in which patients consume about 100 grams of glucose, duplicates eating a huge quantity of junk food. Even normal people can feel ill from this experience. Invariably, within 2 or 3 weeks, their symptoms diminish and they gain the ability to delay eating without feeling ill. They can then follow the same diet I recommend for everyone without feeling any ill effects. If you have this condition, you must also avoid alcohol, coffee, tea, artificial flavorings, and food additives. Fresh fruit does not need to be restricted. Headache sufferers rejoice. Recurrent headaches are not much different. They are almost always the result of nutritional folly and, like other reasons that keep doctors' offices busy, are completely avoidable. The relationship between food triggers and migraines has been the subject of much debate, with varying results from medical researchers. Headache specialists such as Seymour Diamond, director of the Diamond Headache Clinic at Columbus Hospital in Chicago, report that about 30% of patients can identify food triggers. My experience in treating migraine and severe headache patients with a more comprehensive nutritional approach has shown that 90 to 95% of patients are able to remain headache-free after the first 3-month period. These patients avoid common migraine triggers, but also in the healing phase, they adhere to a strict natural food vegan diet of primarily fruits and vegetables rich in natural starches, such as squash and brown rice. These patients must avoid all packaged and processed foods, which are notorious for containing hidden food additives, even though they are not disclosed on the labels. They also avoid all added salt. I believe I obtained such impressive results not merely because of avoiding triggers, but because the patient becomes healthier and is able to process toxins more effectively. Additionally, when animal product consumption is significantly lowered or removed from the diet, the liver is not faced with breaking down this heavy toxic load and can perform its normal detoxification function more effectively. Very often in the initial phase of my program, when patients are on a diet with a lower level of tissue irritants, a headache will be precipitated. In other words, it is possible that the patient will initially feel worse, not better. I encourage such patients not to take medication during this initial phase, if at all possible. Instead, I recommend that they drape a cold washcloth over their forehead and lie down in a dark room to rest. The prescribed diet, very low in sodium and animal protein, resolves the headaches in the large majority of patients. If it does not, not all is lost because some fasting usually clears up the problem in most of the remaining headache sufferers. My patients begin by following a diet along the lines of the one described on the next page. They are instructed not to take any medication after the first week. After that time, they are encouraged to control their pain with ice, hot showers, and pressure bands. They will never recover if they don't first detoxify themselves of their addiction to pain medications. These medications may offer pain relief, but they perpetuate the headache at the same time. Drugs that are used for headache, such as acetaminophen, Tylenol, barbiturates, codeine, and ergotamines, all cause headaches to recur on a rebound basis as these toxins begin to wash out of the nervous system. Even a little aspirin can cause a chronic daily headache syndrome. Common migraine triggers: sweets, fermented foods, pizza, monosodium glutamate, or MSG, yeast, dairy and cheese, chocolate, smoked meats, nuts, hydrolyzed protein, salted or pickled foods, vinegar, alcohol, food additives, and baked goods. The first phase of the anti-headache diet is followed strictly for 2 weeks. Then, if the person is headache-free, I expand the diet to include a wider variety of fruits and begin to add beans in the second phase. I usually have the patient avoid nuts for the first few weeks because these bother some people. All dairy and yeast should be avoided as well. Phase 1 anti-headache diet with a greater than 90% cure rate. For breakfast, melon, apple, or pear, oatmeal and water, no sweetener, yeast-free whole grain bread. Lunch, large green salad with 1 teaspoon of olive oil, 1 starchy vegetable or grain, like corn, sweet potato, or brown rice, grapes, pear, or apple. Dinner, large green salad with tomatoes, with 1 teaspoon of olive oil, 1 steamed green vegetable, string beans, asparagus, artichokes, broccoli, zucchini, 1 starchy vegetable or grain, butternut or acorn squash, potato, millet, whole wheat pasta, tomato sauce, unsalted is permitted. Autoimmune diseases and all the rest. If dangerous drugs were the only way for a person to gain relief from suffering, we would be forced to accept the drawbacks of conventional therapy for autoimmune illnesses. The reality is, however, that dietary and nutritional interventions work for autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis. Caring for such patients has been a major portion of my work as a physician for the past 20 years. I have seen scores of rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and connective tissue disease patients recover completely through these interventions. Many of my patients have also made complete recoveries from allergies and asthma. Not every patient obtains a complete remission, but the majority are able to avoid the use of medication. The key to treating autoimmune illnesses is to obey the H equals N divided by C formula. Only then can the immune system begin to normalize its haywire circuitry. Research studies from around the world confirm that this approach is effective. While more research is needed in this area, all the studies that have been done are predictably positive and document improvement in blood inflammatory markers as well as patient symptoms. I see this occur on a daily basis. Here are the main ways to increase the possibility of obtaining remission or improvement in patients with autoimmune diseases. 1. A strict plant-based vegan, dairy-free, wheat-free, and gluten-free diet is usually necessary. A lower protein diet is helpful. 2. A high nutrient per calorie density with caloric restriction sufficient to obtain a normal weight is essential. 3. Arachidonic acid and DHA levels should be checked with an essential fatty acid profile. If the fatty acid balance is abnormal, supplementation with omega-3 fatty acids to achieve satisfactory balance may be necessary. Ground flax seeds, pure plant-derived DHA, or in some cases, high-potency fish oil can be used. 4. Therapeutic fasting can be an extremely effective adjunct to control the autoimmune response and reset the hyperactive immune system to a more normal, lower, level of activity. Do not fast if you are dependent on multiple immunosuppressive drugs, such as methotrexate and Imuron, as it is not safe to fast while on such medication. It is essential that patients contemplating this therapy be properly supervised by a physician. Those interested in learning more about therapeutic fasting for autoimmune illness should read my book, Fasting and Eating for Health. Physicians can request medical journal articles, including case studies that I wrote about this therapy, along with comprehensive medical references from me via my website, drfurman.com, or office. 5. Undertaking food elimination and challenge can uncover hidden food sensitivities. Most of the offending foods have already been eliminated, animal products, wheat and dairy, but many patients find other foods that can worsen their condition as well. These foods are not routinely uncovered with allergy testing. It usually requires a short period of fasting and then the gradual introduction of only one new food each day, eliminating any food that causes an increase in pain over the fasted state. I would like to repeat this to make it clear. The elevated levels of IgG and IgE against various foods on allergy tests are indeed common in patients with rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases. However, there is not an adequate clinical correlation between those foods and the foods we find to be aggravating the symptoms. Other researchers have noted the same thing. I usually instruct patients to save their money and forego these tests. Diet is the first line of defense. Working with patients with autoimmune diseases such as connective tissue disease, myositis, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus is very rewarding. These patients were convinced that they could never get well and are usually eternally grateful to be healthy again and not require medication. I regularly get notes and letters, such as these unsolicited comments. After 3 months, I am off all drugs. Richard Aroni. I would like to shout, Dr. Furman did it. Fred Reddington. 6 months ago, I prayed I would die. Now I'm ready to live again. Jennifer Fulham. Thank you for saving my life. Harriet Fleming. An aggressive nutritional approach to autoimmune illnesses should always be tried first when the disease is in its infancy. Logically, the more advanced the disease is and the more damage that has been done by the disease, the less likely the patient will respond. My experience with inflammatory diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis is that some patients are more dietary sensitive than others and that some patients have very high levels of inflammation that are difficult to curtail with natural therapy. Nevertheless, the majority benefit, and since the conventional drugs used to treat these types of illnesses are so toxic and have so many risky side effects, the dietary method should be tried first. Modern drugs often contribute to the disability and misery of patients with an autoimmune illness and increase cancer risk. Studies show that the long-term outcome is poor after 20 years of taking such medication. A study in the British Journal of Rheumatology showed the major drugs to treat rheumatoid arthritis, such as azathioprine, cyclophosphamide, chlorambucil, and methotrexate, increase the likelihood that the person will die of cancer. Patients who use drugs that suppress the immune system forego some protection that the immune system offers against infection and cancer. These individuals need a superior diet, even if they can't stop all medication. So many of the patients I see, especially the ones who have made recoveries, are angry at their former physicians who did not even suggest nutrition before starting them on medication. These individuals are usually so sick of being sick, they will do anything to get well. They don't find the diet restrictive and show enthusiasm and determination to recover their health. It is terrifically exciting to see such patients make recoveries and eliminate the need for medication. Diseases resolve or improve with nutritional excellence. Other conditions that also respond exceptionally well to dietary modification include menstrual complaints and irritable bowel syndrome. Researchers testing similar diets to the one I recommend have noted that low-fat vegetarian diet increases sex hormone-binding globulin as it reduces estrogen activity. This not only reduces one's risk of breast cancer, but also significantly reduces the pain and bloating associated with menstruation. I also see a large number of patients with irritable bowel syndrome. Some feel better within 3 days of following this diet, although others take a few weeks or longer to adjust to the comparatively large amount of fiber. Both animal products and flour products are triggers for bowel symptoms in many individuals. British researchers have documented that increased production of methane and other gaseous products representing increased fermentation in the colon from meats, dairy products, and refined grains correlate with bowel complaints. However, there are other mechanisms by which a natural food diet high in nutrients and fiber reestablishes normal gut motility and tone. It can take time to undo a lifetime of wrong eating. Most of my patients need 3 months to see improvement. Of course, sometimes diets have to be modified for individual uniqueness. In such cases, working with a knowledgeable physician is helpful. Most chronic illnesses have been earned from a lifetime of inferior nutrition, which eventually results in abnormal function or frequent discomfort. These illnesses are not beyond our control. They are not primarily genetic, and they are not the normal consequences of aging. True, we all have our weakest links governed by genetics, but these weak links need never reveal themselves unless our health deteriorates. Superior health flows naturally as a result of superior nutrition. Our predisposition to certain illnesses can remain hidden. Certainly, this method of healing is not for everybody. Some would prefer to eat conventionally and take whatever medication is indicated for their condition. That is their inalienable right. However, it is also the right of sick and suffering individuals who seek a natural approach to be aware of how effective aggressive nutritional interventions can be. I would like to take these patients down the streets of Manhattan for a ticker tape parade to spread the word. You don't have to be sick. Remember, health is your greatest wealth. Chapter 8. Your plan for substantial weight reduction. Case study. Emily lost 100 pounds and took years off her body. In just 2 months, her blood pressure and cholesterol stats reflected healthy numbers. Quote, "When I first started the journey to get my health back, I was obese and depressed, and I knew I was very ill. It was an effort just to get out of bed in the morning. I knew that if I was ever going to succeed, I had to have something simple and concrete to follow. I had dieted in the past, and I always felt deprived and miserable, but for the first time I was eating lots of good quality food and feeling great doing it. Within the first month I dropped 20 pounds, and my cholesterol dropped from 214 to 145. That solidified my desire to commit to Dr. Furman's nutritional wisdom for the rest of my life. After reading Eat to Live, I knew I had my answer. I kept copies of the 6-week plan with me at all times and used it to guide all my decisions. Those first couple of weeks, I didn't feel like eating romaine lettuce, collard greens, or Brussels sprouts. I followed the plan. I was heavily addicted to salt, creamy cottage cheese, ranch dressing, cheddar cheese, and crunchy peanut butter. I followed the plan. I craved diet cola, diet pudding, and my usual bedtime snack of a large bowl of cereal and milk. I followed the plan. My son became seriously ill and life suddenly became an out-of-control roller coaster. I followed the plan. He had to be transferred to a hospital in another state, and I had to find my way around a new city. I followed the plan. The hospital cafeteria food looked comforting and inviting, and the candy in the gift shop called out my name. I followed the plan. 3 months later, back home, I got on the scale. I was 40 pounds lighter, and more important, I was no longer addicted to toxic foods. I now craved fresh greens and fruits. Diet soda, diet desserts, and salty foods tasted disgusting to me. I walked for 1/2 hour every morning and evening and felt great. My body was thoroughly refreshed after a good night's sleep, and my brain fog had completely disappeared. When I started my journey, I weighed 226 pounds, and now I weigh 126. That's a total weight loss of 100 pounds, which I've kept off. That's a big deal for me, because in the past, I would gain weight back immediately after quitting a diet. This is for life." End quote. What have we learned so far? First, eating foods with too few nutrients is bad for your health. Second, a large amount of animal products in your diet correlates with a vast number of diseases. Last, unrefined plant foods offer the best protection against disease. The question is, how can we translate this data into a health program that will help us achieve a healthy weight, maximize our well-being, and let us enjoy meals at the same time? That is, in part, what the rest of this book will answer. The first part of this chapter describes exactly what I want you to do for the next 6 weeks of your life. The rest of the chapter shows how you can incorporate these principles into the rest of your life in a practical and sensible way, the life plan, with more flexibility than the 6-week plan, including both vegetarian and non-vegetarian options. The life plan is a nutritarian diet. I coined the term nutritarian to describe someone who strives for more micronutrients per calorie in their diet style. A nutritarian understands that food has powerful disease-protecting and therapeutic effects and seeks to consume a broad array of micronutrients via their food choices.